Ladies and gentlemen, nice of you to stop by today. I hope you're doing well. It's New Year's Eve and we are trucking along here at Red Ice, keeping you company during the busy season. So thank you for taking some time off. It's great to have you here. Of course, we always appreciate when you tune in as we continue to focus on important topics, analyzing, investigating, and exposing lies and dispelling the myth makers. RedIceCreations.com is our website. We also have RedIceMembers.com for the full archive and RedIceRadio.net for the open archive. We have Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire back with us on the program today to talk about the Ferguson debacle. We have a lot lined up today, so stay with us. Welcome back, Patrick. Thank you again for coming on with us. It's good speaking with you again.
Yeah, great to be back, Henrik. Really great.
Well, good. Let's begin with Ferguson and the media war that has been happening since the time of Darren Wilson and Michael Brown. I've been watching this with, this grave injustice exacerbated by the media solely on racial lines. White equals bad, black equals good. It doesn't matter what the evidence says or what the reports and the analysis points to, or even if, you know, crimes actually have been committed or not. They are now actually even selling out the police. Their beloved police state is being thrown to the side in order to favor the media's, you know, PC narrative, which is quite interesting, quite telling, actually. But, you know, the media have been hammering away at this, simplifying the issues over and over again ever since Zimmerman. Well, I'd say before this too, actually, but they have really been, you know, beating away on their one-stringed banjo how to deal with these issues. And they're creating distrust in law enforcement and justifying the riots and the looters and the so-called protests that we've seen. And the damage they're doing here, you know, the media is far worse than anything their opponents to this mess have done in this situation. And I agree with you what you said, Patrick, in one of your articles about Ferguson and the issue that they basically would not have been happy until Darren Wilson was, you know, hung in the town square or something like that. What's your take on the situation?
Yes, yeah, the Ferguson protest, it's important to know that all those protests that we saw in Ferguson in July, they were really the outgrowth of public outrage. And you really have to trace the genesis of this right back to its beginning. What was the public outrage about? The public outrage hinged on one person's story. That was the best friend of Michael Brown. His name was Dorian Johnson. I think he was in his early 20s, 21 or 22 years old, resident of Ferguson, was with Michael Brown when the incident took place with Officer Darren Wilson. And immediately after the incident, Dorian Johnson, this young lad, stepped in front of the media. He was being handled by a gentleman who has a television show in America on MSNBC. That's a network that's pretty much affiliated with the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and he was being handled by Al Sharpton from National Action Network, which is a racial or black rights, civil rights, supposedly lobbyist group that collects a lot of money every year. And Sharpton himself is a multimillionaire as a result. But he's a former FBI informant and a professional street agitator. And he was handling Dorian Johnson immediately. He had his people with him, talking to him, getting perhaps even getting his story lined up for the media and what he was going to say about what happened. And so he really made these statements to the media immediately. The statements was that Michael Brown and him were just minding their own business, walking along on a summer's day, and this racist police officer came up, grabbed Michael Brown, and then tried to strangle him and then shot him in the back after Michael Brown had his hands up saying, "Don't shoot." That was the story that Dorian Johnson fed to the media, which became the narrative of Ferguson immediately. That was picked up by every major network, pretty much every newspaper globally. So the public outrage was triggered, and people then converged on Ferguson, came from all over America, many from New York City. Many were flown in, bussed in as well. We had thousands of people who were there as professional activists and also just about as many media too, mainstream and alternative media. So it turns out that Dorian Johnson's story was a total fabrication. And this, to this day, most people aren't aware of that. They don't realize that he actually flipped on his story, but he probably flipped on August 12th, 3 days after the shooting, when he told, when the FBI interviewed him with his attorney present, and he probably told them what really happened because they already knew what happened because they had interviewed everybody else, all the other eyewitnesses. Then it went to a grand jury, and all the grand jury testimonies were released to the public only a few weeks ago, except one. One testimony was not released to the public, and it was then put in custody of Eric Holder in the Department of Justice, and that was Dorian Johnson's testimony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this whole charade was constructed in the immediate aftermath of the Michael Brown, Officer Wilson shooting. And it was allowed to be held in place in order to, perhaps they wanted to save Dorian Johnson from public ridicule or mob outrage because he flipped his story. And of course, that's why the grand jury came back with no indictments, because their key witness, the star witness, was proven to be lying, basically. And this wasn't covered by the media because they had already run with the story of the gentle giant, Michael Brown, and the hands up, don't shoot. And you still have mobs to this day lying in street intersections all over America, taking selfies, saying, hands up, don't shoot,
mm-hmm.
hashtagging all over the place. And it's really based on a lie. So it's quite interesting. This is how activism is disseminated in the 21st century. It's done on Twitter.
Yep,
it's done on social media. It's done with short little hits, 142 characters. So anything that can be articulated in 142 characters is going to drive the zeitgeist.
The war of the slogans, yep.
Yeah. So, and if it's anything that requires deeper analysis or additional qualifications, is going to be discounted as too complicated. And so this is activism light in the 21st century, and that's exactly what we have. So this has sprung then into a racial thing, and that's the most concerning thing about it, and that's one of the main reasons why we're having this discussion today, is because in both cases of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner, who in my opinion had a much stronger case than Michael Brown in terms of the police brutality or excessive force argument, but there wasn't any racial motivation in either of those cases, and it can't be proven. It won't be proven, even though Dorian Johnson lied, even though you can't prove there was any racial motivation or racial targeting in any of these cases, the U.S. federal government still pressed forward with federal investigations, deploying an unprecedented number of FBI agents to do door-to-door interviews with people in Ferguson, 40 FBI agents out of the St. Louis office, and ordered a federal autopsy as a second opinion on Michael Brown. This is all done by Eric Holder, who's Barack Obama's right hand as Attorney General. So knowing full well this whole thing was based on a lie, they still pressed forward to try to find some way to create a racial or civil rights case. And they're obviously are going to fail because there is no racial motivation in it. But what they've done is they have created a wave, a political wave, which has swept across the country, which is Democratic Party shaped and very much using race as the driving force behind this political wave, saying that America has a racism crisis, or there's a crisis of race in America and we have to deal with this and so forth. So I'm contending here that there is a crisis, but it's been conjured up through media, through social media, through people like Al Sharpton, through politicians like Eric Holder, who's acting like a politician in this case and not a attorney general. Barack Obama certainly has responsibility here, as does many other politicians and media people who have just basically pressed this as a racial crisis. There wasn't a racial crisis apparently before this happened, but there is now. And now you have Samuel Jackson, many high-profile Hollywood people or media people, Samuel Jackson putting out a song on the internet saying the racist police and so forth. So it's just kind of getting ridiculous now.
Yeah.
And all this does is it kind of all roads lead to me, all roads lead to next year's Occupy protests. So this is really kind of, in a way, a warm-up for next year's Occupy protests, which will probably be kicking off in the fall, just in time to help Democratic voter registration drives for the 2016 presidential election in America, which will be coming in the primaries beginning the following January. So
right.
we see these patterns repeating themselves quite regularly. In this case, it's really dangerous because this is effectively tried to tear America down the middle. And this is weaponized political correctness at its absolute worst.
Mm-hmm.
This is fundamentally culturally Marxist, and it's creating an identity politics subdivided society, and really trying to enhance political or cultural or racial identity politics, and try to really accentuate that, especially with young people. Even though, in my opinion, young people are very better racially adjusted, let's say, than any of the previous generations. And that will always continue forward. That's just human nature, in my opinion, that it does improve over time, especially in the globalized world we live in, where the person in Hong Kong or the person in Stockholm or London, they all listen to more or less the same music and, you know, consume the same products and so forth.
Horrible.
So on the side of that racial argument, it's only going to improve. It's not going backwards. It's only going forward. And so people are going to be more accepting and more open-minded. That's just the natural evolution of things in our modern
world. At the cost of selling out our cultural heritage and deracinating people, right?
Absolutely. And those sort of issues should be reserved for people in their localities, in their regions, mm-hmm. in their nation states, for instance.
Sorry to interrupt you, Patrick, but so do you think, from your perspective, this is some kind of sacrificial thing on the altar of getting to our, you know, rainbow one world, you know, order kind of thing, that we want to have everyone culturally homogenous? These are the types of events that needs to occur, shedding some of the blood in order to move in the right direction from the political and the PC class, the cultural Marxists perspective? Or what do you think it is? Because, I mean, obviously the media did pick this one up, and it isn't just a one-off. They've been attempting to do this over and over and over again. And the way they picked up Eric Garner, it was a way to kind of a second, you know, revival attempt of trying to get something out of the situation when there are tons of other, you know, cases like it. There's people with, you know, Down's syndrome that's, you know, been died in police hand of asphyxiation and these kinds of issues. But these stories are not picked up. They're very selective, and they choose these as a way to run on them to create the divisions, right?
Sure. We have I hear this argument a lot on the news, on CNN. I mean, CNN has now, well, at least for the last month or two, it's been 24/7. They've had racial experts on, and legal analysts, and just, you know, black legal analysts, but it's just been dominated by this conversation. You'd think that, you know, America wasn't a multicultural or diverse country just by watching CNN over the last 2 months. You'd think it was just a black country only. But Kelly Thomas, they say, well, point to me one example of a white person who's a victim of police brutality. And I just said, Kelly Thomas, who was beaten to death by Fullerton police. He was homeless, had mental issues, not unlike Eric Garner in New York, although much worse, I would say, in terms of how far down the road he was in terms of being a street person. But he was on camera as well, beaten to death by five or six officers, literally beaten to death. And it was almost as bad as the Rodney King video. And all of those officers, I don't even think they faced a grand jury. There was no grand jury. And they're still working on the force. So that is a gross injustice. My point is, this happens to both white and black people.
Yeah.
It's not exclusive just to black people in America. And that might be upsetting for some people to hear, but it's true. In fact, You shared some statistical numbers with me from the different reports that are out there.
Yeah.
I don't know, that it might be more likely that if you're white, you will get shot. It's more likely you will be shot in America, or you will be a victim of police brutality just by the numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll link to that as well, Patrick, so people can take a look at it. But it's actually the annual firearms discharge report from 2011 from the New York Police Department. And, you know, it's a long report, but it basically confirms that although blacks accounted for about 72% of criminal shooters in New York, they only accounted for 22% of those actually killed by police. And then on the flip side of that, whites, who committed just 3% of the criminal shootings in New York, accounted for 44% of suspects killed by the New York City Department. So it's a huge, you know, statistical difference here. And the fact is, again, that there's like, I think it was officers were less likely also to actually erroneously shoot unarmed black suspects than they were unarmed whites. I think it was 25 times less likely, in fact. So the statistical margins here are huge. And yet again, these are official reports from the police department, stuff like that. You think the media would, who usually just pick up on the official line, would look at these kinds of numbers and realize that what they're peddling is just nonsense, but they're not, for some reason, you know?
Sure. I mean, as we're at, and also the issue of, it's been brought up by a lot of people in media and discussions and debates, black on black crime. As we speak during this show right now that we're having in 2 hours, there will be a murder, a black on black murder somewhere in America, probably in Chicago. It's one of the highest murder rates in the world as a major city. And, you know, so when you see the hashtag Black Lives Matter, well, I think that, you know, I think that there is an argument that many people have made that the so-called black community in America is more concerned about these outlying issues that have no racial element to them at all, like Michael Brown and like the Eric Garner case, and are not wanting to put any focus on violence within their own communities. And that's because, and there's a reason for that. And it's not to do with race or anything. It's to do with politics and power, because there is no political capital in championing the issue of black on black crime. If you're an Al Sharpton, if you're an Eric Holder, if you're a Barack Obama. So it's kind of sad and very tragic, in my opinion, that people in the highest positions of government would use race as a political wedge, or I'm gonna re-say that, using wedge as a political crowbar to pry open some of the oldest wounds that were healing in America. And that's exactly what they've done. And the reason they've done it is interesting, Henrik, and there's more to this than people realize. There is the opportunism, you know, that's at play here. And it's obvious with people like Al Sharpton or Eric Holder. It's just what I would class as compulsive political behavior, which is mainly the purpose is to promote themselves, to build up their own personal brands, but also to try to grab as much political capital as possible. Have you ever seen those old scenes of the old game show where you step inside the plastic bubble and there's a fan underneath and it shoots up money and you have to grab as much cash as you can within 30 seconds and then you get to keep what you win? That's kind of the same thing that's going on with this compulsive political behavior. They're creating chaos. It's throwing everything up in the air, and they have to grab as many voters, as much donations, fundraising opportunities, political appointments. That's all political capital. And there's only a limited time when you can accumulate this. And that's usually during the lifespan of the crisis, the quote crisis. So in this case, this is compounded by the mob. And people don't realize, even today in 2014, although maybe not as much as other times in past history, we're talking about the French Revolution or in ancient Rome, but the mob still has a lot of power. And in fact, I'm gonna say that the mob is the top of the political pyramid in this particular conversation. So Eric Holder, who was Obama's right hand, bowed to public pressure. Okay, so he himself became a victim of his own hubris. And when he landed in Ferguson to, you know, make his presence known that the White House was involved in investigating this racist complaints against the police department, get justice for the Brown family and so forth. So that was his political hubris. But then the mob took over. And so he had to do something that he knew full well was wrong, because even the president is afraid of the mob. The real power in all of this is the mob. So the mob's at the top, then there's the president, then the attorney general, then the government, and then, you know, the media as well works with the mob, and gives the mob a bully pulpit to get these things across. And live by the sword, die by the sword. You can hear the fear in President Obama's voice when he's addressing this issue, because he knows if he makes one wrong move, that even the black community will overrun him in a second. And there's a lot of people already calling for, you know, his head in the black community, because he hasn't done enough to get justice for Michael Brown or Eric Garner. So what you have is mob justice. So the mob comes out and they demand their version of justice, which is whatever the mob wants. And what does the mob normally want? The mob's only happy when they see a pound of flesh or when they see blood throughout history. And that's the only thing that can really make a mob happy. Aside from that, you have burning down buildings, which we saw in Ferguson. We have destruction of property, of businesses, violence. We saw all those things as well in New York, in Oakland. So this mob was unleashed based on what is my question. And It's really based on a fallacy, based on an idea that was very vague. And again, this looks very similar to me like the Occupy movement, although this was kind of a lightweight warm-up of another Occupy. No real direction, just a lot of participation. And usually the level of political awareness of the people out on the street is very low, in fact, in terms of what their understanding of the system which they're living in. It's very low, very superficial, and a lot of selfies being taken by people. And it seems to be feeding in also into that new narcissistic culture, which has kind of overrun United States and Western Europe as well. Through social media and so forth. So it's really interesting, and it does rally around certain political correct tenets. And we saw this professor, in fact, the president of the Cal State University, Long Beach, which is a major California university, comes out and basically puts forth the idea last week that all white people are inherently racist because they're born with this white privilege.
Oh, of course. Yes.
So that in biblical terms, you're talking about the concept of original sin. So what they've done is they've taken something like an original sin, which is a well-known, age-old, tried, tested, and proven archetype. And they've now transposed that into politics here, identity politics. And that is, I mean, who better to give you a lesson than the president of a Cal State University to give you a perfect example of cultural Marxism 101 for the freshman class?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So it's you know, this is absolutely what we stepped in here with Ferguson, with even with I Can't Breathe and Occupy and all these things. This is cultural Marxism. This is their matrix. So it's check your privilege. We covered that last year as well. This thing that's spreading on U.S. campuses, which is very much like a Taliban, same sort of thing. You have clerics who are politically correct clerics who go around telling people to you can't talk about women because you're a man. You can't talk about gay and lesbians because you're straight. You can't talk about black people because you're white. And check your privilege. And all that is a simple neurolinguistic programming device, an NLP device that's designed to basically stop any debate or discussion and then turn the focus on the person themselves who's wanting to make a point, shutting them up basically and saying, well, look at yourself. you're the wrong color to be talking about this. Mm. You're the wrong gender. And so again, and this is a command and control mechanism. So this is these are the sort of things that are just basically spreading like viruses through our university campuses. And so this is really the league of the middle class, or the what used to be called yuppies, and then was called, is redefined as the bobo, or the sort of bohemian bourgeois. But these are the sort of people that coalesce around these ideas, who send their children to these particular universities and these particular ideas. And then you have class identity, which is setting in now in America, which is another trend. Americans are becoming very class conscious now. And this wasn't the case 30 years ago.
And it's a new type of classes here as well. It's creating a creation of all these different victim classes. And this is what you're using, to drive politics, to shape, policy and what direction to go. And whoever, shouts the loudest, basically, kind of controls the dialogue, at least for a while. And the bottom line of all this, though, is that we have a ton of willful accomplices in this, idiots who are, playing into this game. And so let's just go back to that question again of who directs, the mob and for what purposes here. If we have this type of mentality spreading at the campuses, if we have these kinds of messages in the media, is this somehow, you mentioned something that this is driven by with the election coming up in 2016 in mind from the Democratic Party view in order to, break down the stability in America, or how do you view that? Who's actually pulling the strings here and for what reason?
Well, it's very similar. This is an interesting part of the discussion here, because now we're getting into the mechanics of what we're seeing on the street, how it actually works and how it functions, where the cogs in the sort of machine. And if you look at something like the Arab Spring, you look at, and you've covered that extensively with your different guests, and I've covered this as well through articles. And also at the same time, the Occupy movement was happening. So it was a great test tube to learn and see how these things work. And if you look at the Arab Spring and you look at the concept behind how the Arab Spring happened, the Arab Spring was not organic. The Arab Spring was prepackaged. In fact, it's absolutely proven now and it's very well documented, not just by myself, but by documentary filmmakers, journeyman films, and so forth, about the revolution business, where the student leaders were taken and trained offshore at conferences and seminars and taught how to do everything from social media to the print marketing for their slogans, for the demonstrations, how to organize, and so forth. That's done by some consultancies, which are kind of regime change consultancies, one of them being out of Belgrade originally, called Canvas, who's, I believe one of their people was there from Serbia, I forgot his name, was there in Ferguson, I think. I saw in one report something that I believe that was him, mm-hmm. Not sure. But right. But the Canvas or Optor was one of the people contracted, and who's paying their bills is the National Endowment for Democracy and all these other sort of pro-democracy NGOs and foundations and so forth, and George Soros being quite a big player in that sort of industry,
sure. Yeah.
Social change industry. So that's how it works in the Arab Spring, in Tunisia, in Egypt, and some of these countries. Okay, now all they've done there is they've gone in, and there's it could have started. It could have very well have started with good intentions with the core founders. But once the thing starts to catch steam, then it becomes valuable for a lot of people. And that's what happened in Ferguson. Okay. So that, and what it is that's potentially social unrest. You see the worst expression of this in Syria, what started off as an internal political dispute, which might have been triggered over something small, that turned into something big. And in the case of Syria, you have a civil war. In the case of Ferguson, it erupted locally and then it calmed down, but it reverberated through all the political classes across the United States, and so forth. So it's the same process is what I'm saying. There's those same organizations, and there's hundreds of them now in the United States. I mean, I'm running into people in any city I go to, and I've especially found this out when I was covering stories that had a humanitarian angle to it. I'd meet people and they'd say, well, I said, what do you do? And they say, I'm a community organizer. And I was out of the United States for quite a few years, so I missed all this. But this has been building up over the last decade. So there's young people who, that's their job. That is their, you know, that's their career of choice is being a community organizer. So they're getting money. They totally exist on the funding of these political action groups. So there's hundreds of them. They were in Ferguson. They were bringing people from New York City to Ferguson. So you have this kind of bussing in of protesters, which the left has traditionally done very well. I saw this with the immigration protests in Marietta, California. They were bussed in. So someone's paying for their lunch, you know, and their day out. And most of them are students, either students, part-time employed, unemployed, and students. This is the main core of these sort of groups. But that's, so it's very well organized.
And that catches on too, right? So, I mean, even if you do have a few numbers showing up, you know, you do have a busload coming in, then I think adding on to that, voluntarily people come and it turns it into a thing, right? I mean, we saw this with the Orange Revolution, have a couple of balloons and a concert, you know, and people come out on the streets and that's it, you know?
Absolutely. It doesn't take a lot for it to snowball. Once it gets media coverage as well, then it takes off into, achieves some kind of velocity in terms of public awareness. And then from there, you know, anything can happen, really.
Yeah.
So it's just surfing that wave. And
people are gullible. I just want to mention that as well. I think it's rooted in some kind of, it can be imposed guilt issues. It could be whatever, but it's, the bottom line is it makes them feel good to be there. This is solely emotionally driven, and that's why it works, you know?
Yeah, it feels good to be there. And that's the mantra of the cultural Marxist movement. What was, if it feels good, do it, basically.
Yeah.
So, and you could apply that to drugs, sexuality, and now you can apply it to politics, quite frankly.
Yeah,
because
right.
it's really been boiled down to that level with politics. And that is really the wave that President Obama came into power on.
Sure. Definitely.
Probably on record, he was, you know, and no one can argue this because his record is his record, the most inexperienced presidential candidate in the history of the United States. One of the youngest, one of the most inexperienced, but he had one thing, which was the color of his skin. And
he's even half white.
He's half white. But most black Americans, African Americans, will tell you that the number one reason why they voted for Barack Obama was because he had darker skin.
Well, of course, it's the lowest common denominator. That's it now. And so, despite the left saying, either that these issues don't exist or we can't do it across those lines, they are radically obsessed with it, and that seems to be the only thing that matters to them, right?
So if I voted for a white presidential candidate based on the color of his skin, that would make me a bigot or a racist, and so the counter argument coming from the cultural Marxist would be, well, that's not, you know, you can't say that we're racist for only wanting to vote for someone because of the color of skin, because we're in the category of the oppressed.
Right.
We're an ethnic minority. So we basically get a free pass on anything that you might consider as being divisive or racist. So it's not about race. It's at the end of the day, it's not about black or white. Okay. Cause you can transpose these identities and give them different labels depending on what country you're in, okay, or what society you're in. It's not about race. It's about cultural Marxism. And the cultural Marxists are the Saul Alinsky's. These are the, you know, UC Berkeley crowd in the 1960s. This is the University of Columbia. This is the Frankfurt Institute, which we've talked about in previous shows. The skilled cultural Marxist will look at the mosaic of society in front of them, and they'll look for the cracks. They'll look for the places where they can take a nail or a wedge and a hammer, and they can just tap and it will crack and maybe come apart. And so they're looking for all these opportunities to divide society, because for them, that is how they organize. That is their sort of modus operandi, is about dividing communities by race, by class, because this is the only way that they can accumulate power, the cultural Marxist.
Yeah.
The cultural Marxist is the foot soldier of the communist, the Marxist himself, which wants to put in this new social order, which is total collectivism. Okay. Those are and that's the idealist. Okay.
I wonder if they will be able to build that up, though, because I mean, look at their track record. All they know how to do is to subvert things, upset them, deconstruct things, ruin things. You know, if there's, you know, order somewhere, then we got to go in there and screw it up. You know, where there's homogeneity, for example, we got to cause chaos in these areas. It's a very destructive, path that they're on. So my question has been, even if they manage to build something up, you know, what kind of world would that be, built on these kinds of fundamental issues, that it's all about breaking down, eroding, and destroying what's there, right?
Yes. And I think as we progress as socioeconomically and technologically as well, that's a big part of it too, is technological advancements. But as we progress forward on our journey, then again, those things that you just mentioned there, some of them become less appealing to a lot of people. In other words, to destroy, to deface, to deconstruct. As people don't want to destroy, deface, and deconstruct a lot of their environment anymore. Maybe they did in pre-Bolshevik Russia or in other places at other times in history. But so they have to find a different sort of appeal. And it's about deconstructing, defacing the individual. And so this is more and more, this is becoming not just a political issue, not just an issue about pure Marxist politics and economic theories. It's becoming more an individual over the individual's sovereignty. This is what it's becoming more about.
Yeah,
it's become a spiritual war, that has always been the final frontier, has been the spiritual chasm.
Yeah, because you know, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's the more you kind of look at this, it's a war on human nature. It's a war on biology or who we are or things like that, right?
And common sense.
Exactly. That too.
Common sense is synonymous with human nature. You can't talk about common sense, what is common through man, without talking about human nature. They're one and the same. And so, again, the cultural Marxist wants to separate the concept of common sense and to maybe minimize it, mitigate it, and then throw it out the window completely, because that basically runs counter to their idea of collectivism, which is that there is no individual, there is no such thing. You can't own this. You can't create this. Everything that you do, everything you think, everything you feel belongs to the collective, and so therefore your identity is superseded by the collective.
Yeah,
and so it is a kind of a religion.
Certainly. Yes.
Dark religion in a way. It's the environment of the technocrat and the person who likes to control, the control freak, the technocrat, the micromanager. This is their natural habitat. So this is what they like. And so in order to be able to perform in that environment, which they like, they need a system, which is a collective system. So it's fundamental. It's fundamental to the technocrat. And so that's why technocrats, you could have a collectivist, communist system. But it's going to be run and it's going to be managed, and there's going to be tiers and classes within that system. That's just expected.
Let me also say this, because it's an attempt, of course, from their perspective to erode, erode society, break these things down, as you clarified. I totally agree with you there. And then at the same time, then they have a view that it's like their right to be, subvertive against government. I mean, you're incapable of restoring any kind of stability and order in a scenario where you're dealing with people who basically see it as their human right to be to destabilize everything or try to, you know, pick at everything, either if it's nitpick or, you know, literally try to break things down of governmental structures. Now, it is in a position where it can no longer, you know, protect itself or defend itself, or as soon as it makes a move, it's either police brutality or, you know, government oppression or whatever. And it's like it becomes impossible to live with those kinds of, you know, differences between these humans.
Yes. So what you just described there is exactly that's one of the attitudes that's become pervasive through this whole discussion in America about police violence, about Ferguson and about Eric Garner and so forth, is exactly what you've just said, Henrik, which is fundamentally an anarchist viewpoint.
Yeah.
And so these, they're not calling themselves anarchists, but they're basically putting forward an anarchist tenet, a major fundamental principle of anarchy, which is that, you know, we don't respect authority. We don't respect justice. We want to define what justice is going to be from this point forward. We don't need police. We don't need rule of law. We don't need protection of property. We have no respect for private property.
Because it doesn't exist, right?
Yes, because in the idea of the Marxist, it doesn't exist. So you can see the ideas of, so all anarchy is obviously, it's not an end in itself. Anarchy is a means to an end for a Marxist or a cultural Marxist. It's only a means to achieve an end. It is not the end in itself. So they will tap into the, and people have a natural propensity for anarchy. I mean, everybody from your sort of geek rebel to your, you know, musician or your artist or that person in the office that has got, you know, pierced earrings and dyed red hair. Everyone's got a bit of an anarchist streak in them because that's equated with the idea of freedom or not being oppressed by the system, mm-hmm. or yep. not being conformist. So everyone's got a little bit of an anarchist streak in them. They don't like to be told what to do. They like to do their own thing. They say, leave me alone. I can handle it myself. Okay. So what they're doing within here is when you get the mob together, as we've seen in Ferguson, Michael Brown's stepfather stepping on top of a back of a truck saying, burn this bitch down.
Yeah.
To an angry mob. And then obviously we see him last week at the White House with Al Sharpton, in front of the Washington Memorial at this million man march last weekend, which wasn't a million people, didn't show up. Unfortunately, it was only a few tens of thousands, but, so they're using this instability. They're using this opportunity to dangle the carrot, you know, of anarchy, which is very seductive. It turns a lot of people on. It's an aphrodisiac, for some people in political terms. Okay. But it's only a means to an end. The end is basically political power and a rigid structure, which is a collectivist or a communist structure. And although a lot of people can't articulate this, this is what they're actually participating in. And most people don't realize when they're in a mob what role they're actually playing or what is the sort of political product of their activity. They just don't know. They're going as a collective. And this is the problem. And this is usually where things go horribly wrong socially. And I dare say that this is going to be a big risk in the years to come. We have a problem right now in Europe with emerging far right wing fascist sympathizing groups who are basically railing against the open borders immigration policy that's been set upon most European countries, which is probably a social engineering policy enacted by the European Union and Britain and others.
Look at Kalergi, you know, what he said.
Yeah. What did he say this week?
Well, no. He's the ideological founder of it, Richard Kudinov Kalergi, who started the pan-European movement together with Otto von Habsburg. And he talked about a completely erosion of ethnically homogenous European nations. And he wanted to see what he described, and this is his word, a European Negroid Mongoloid race arise from this, much in the vein of the old Egyptians. So it's a complete ethnic cleansing plan that he set in motion. And that's what we're seeing in Europe right now. I mean, there's no other way about it. And I understand why people are upset about this. They didn't ask for it. There hasn't been any voting on these issues, you know. And then, of course, as we talked about previously on the show, you know, who's driving the war industry and all these issues, why there's upheaval in the world, etc. But nonetheless, there is a tremendous chaotic circumstantial scenario that is blooming out in Europe right now. And I definitely understand the anti-European Union sentiments that are on the rise, and I support those sentiments as well, because we got to get out of that. That centralized government is ruining European civilization, you know.
Yeah, it means that things can't develop naturally or organically. And of course, there is a natural bit of instability sometimes when you leave things to occur on their own volition. But there's the technocrat doesn't like that. The technocrat has no faith in human nature. The technocrat has no faith in humanity's decision to make the right decisions, or, you know, humanity's ability to adapt and overcome obstacles and so forth. This is something the technocrat wants to do away with, wants complete centralized command and control of everything, including social engineering. So when you get into this conversation you just had about the emerging new European white Mongoloid combination race, this is, you know, you're getting into the area of the eugenicist or the Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah, the dysgenicists.
The David Rockefellers. You know. But it basically overriding command and control of major social development, and so that requires a technocracy to achieve that, and that's kind of, so you have the right wing reaction to this, and also the predictable blaming unemployment on immigrants, and that's the normal arguments that come forward and so forth. Not addressing central bank fractional reserve lending, debt-based currency problems that are inherent in the system as well, that cause hyperinflation and cause a lot of these problems. Okay,
or usury or something. But as soon as you do that, they fling the anti-Semite card on you. Oh, you're talking about bankers? Oh, that's veiled for Jews. And there you go. You know, so it's like they know how to shut down those core issues when you get to the root of the problem. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why we see the response that we do, I think. And despite that, I guess there are some who've actually been trying to, you know, to address on top of things the issue of, you know, the banking sector and the power that the political class holds. But unfortunately, very few of those are lifted out in the media. And all you get as a response by the parrot media, the one banjo, you know, crowd, is, of course, you know, that these, you know, parties that are rising in Europe, they're racists, they're Nazis, they're anti-Semites. And that's all they know how to say about it when there's a valid level of criticism in what they bring to the table, you know?
Yeah. And most of the criticism I've heard is quite valid, and it's rational and it's logical, and they put forward a good argument and asking the other side to refute that argument based on the same principles they put it together, which is some sort of pragmatism, some sort of logic, some sort of common sense, and also factoring in the preserving whatever the culture is, which you're talking about, whatever country you're in, which is an important thing for people who identify themselves with that culture or that nation state.
I think it's extremely important. And again, I think it's one of those reasons why they're kind of just steamrolling over all that. They know, of course, control is important. Or if you want control, you have to, you know, rip that cultural heritage under people's feet. You have to deracinate them. You have to turn them into these, you know, good global citizens. They don't give a shit about their past or about their ancestors or what has been built. And just as you said, it's because, well, you didn't really build that, or like your people didn't really achieve those things, and it's off of the backs of someone else, you know, and bring in the white guilt, etc., and all these things. But it's built on lies. It's not the truth, you know, and that's where my, you know, stance come into the picture, that they're manipulative and they're lying and it's not true. And I can't stand that when they're trying to push people down in that way, you know?
Yeah, so you have that right wing, what they would call conservative or right-wing reaction, then they've created the group on the left, which is basically, you know, fighting against that or pushing back against that reaction. So you have the polarization of society, which in Europe is fairly pronounced. In America, it's becoming more and more pronounced. And events like what we've seen over the last 6 months have helped to solidify that kind of polarized environment.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so in on the other side, so that's domestically in America. And then America also, as well as Australia and other places around the world, have also polarized the international conversation with regards to, let's a good example, Islamic terrorism. So we just had a major attack, so-called attack in Sydney, Australia, a couple of days ago, the Sydney siege, they called it. And so immediately you see society dividing into two distinct groups. Those who are look at this event as a international ISIS-inspired terrorist event, and they're really pumping the fear of Islamofascism as a result of this, what it looks to be an isolated incident, okay, that has in no way, shape, or form is going to defeat Australia's national security apparatus, or it's, you know, the country's not in danger at all of anything. It is what it is. When you look at it from a common sense point of view, it's a mentally ill gunman who took over a cafe, held hostages, and ended up getting killed at the end along with two other hostages. A tragedy by anyone's definition, but not by the definition of the culture makers who want to say, okay, what camp are you in? Are you going to be with us to, you know, warn about the fear of Islamofascism, international terror, and we need to be more vigilant, and we need to go and torture people to get intelligence to stop these types of things from happening? Okay, are you in that camp? Or are you in this camp, which is, oh, this is terrible because this is going to create more Islamophobia in our society, whereby Muslims are going to be wrongly targeted, as they have been for the last 15 years, for terrorist atrocities and being potential terrorists. So that's basically divided along almost the identical political lines as the immigration debate in Europe or the Ferguson debate in the United States. It's the exact same social partitioning politically. And so this has become almost like a piece of software that all you have to do is just tweak that software a little bit in terms of how the public perceives an event or a crisis. And then it becomes, at that point, weaponized. And then it achieves a political division. And I'm very concerned about this in the 21st century, because people are not thinking. They just find themselves in this camp on the left or that camp on the right, and there's no sort of independent thought. Just immediately take on the political identity that's overlaid over any incident or any particular thing in the news or event.
Right. Well, I think there's something, we're going to take a break here in a little bit, but let me wing one more thing by you here. And I think it has to do with, I forget, I was looking for the article as you were speaking about this, but it was about the reasoning also historically why smaller interest groups are seeking itself to the more powerful, again, it's a lowest common denominator kind of issue. I forget the wording of this article, and I apologize for that, but it was basically, you know, you can have all these little different interest groups and all these different little groups or, you know, political factions or what they think, whatever, and then you might have, you know, maybe a kind of a dividing line, you know, down the middle of that, more or less. But you have this kind of spiraling out of control issue that occurs within, if you look at things historically, where, you know, they've realized that we have to centralize on our, among our group, to be able to beat what they consider to be the enemy, right? So that you have, you know, these smaller groups that would, you know, try to pressure on these small little issues. They will basically be like run over by the wheels of history if they don't align themselves with a greater group that can defeat them. We've seen this within, you know, even how societies work, where you're like, all right, you know, we used to fight, you know, we were neighbors, and now we realize we have a greater enemy. You and me have to gang up together because we have to deal with this issue. And that is just a fact of history. It's just a repeating cycle that occurs. And in that sense, yes, it becomes, you know, more extreme. Yes, it becomes more polarized. But at the same time, if they have a dedication to, the, you know, their view or whatever is right, then I mean, there's no way out of that situation. It's just, it's going to happen, and it is, and it's happened in the past, you know?
Yes. You know, it's the sad truth. That's the sad truth of the matter. I mean, the positions that I took on Ferguson and on this whole kind of, you know, situation, this race, what I looks like to me like a kind of virtual race war, which has been sparked off in the United States, which is probably short term. It'll die off after Christmas and will morph into something else. But that was my big concern, is that this is a place where people are saying to each other things that I thought I would never hear again. Like, white people just don't get it. They don't understand what black people go through. They just don't get it because they're white. And I thought this was all consigned to the dustbin of history. I wake up one morning and it's just there back in your face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that is, again, people would attack me. I've got a lot of great comments, positive comments on the stuff I've written, but people attack me and saying, Pat, you're on the wrong side of this issue. I'm worried about you. I thought, you know, are you sure you want to be on this side? Are you sure you want to say what you're saying? You sound like you're supporting the police, and we thought you were against the police state. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all this sort of stuff. And so immediately, me as a journalist, I'm feeling the pressure of the mob essentially saying, you better be on the right side of the mob, or the mob will basically, you know, come after you, exact revenge on you, or it might not, you know, you might lose readership, or you might be singled out for criticism by somebody else. And so, but I've immediately, I resisted that pressure, and I've always resisted that pressure. I've resisted that pressure when I was covering the Palestinian-Israeli issue, because I know that it's not popular to criticize Israel in many circles, especially mainstream circles.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
So if you want to get mainstream approval, or you want to further your career, it's not so much that you need to support Israel, is that you just don't talk about it.
Exactly. Yeah,
so,
that's right.
So, and again, that's a type of a mob as well that's trying to, so it's, people are, like you said, Henrik, people are trying to measure up constantly, mankind, you know, who's the strongest group? And I don't want to be on the wrong side of a group that's stronger than me, or I will be overrun by that group, or that opinion, or that political mode of thought, or whatever. So are you on the right side of history on this event? And that's something that journalists have to resist. And sadly, many don't. And you look at the polarization of our media landscape right now, and it's a perfect evidence that most of them don't have the stones to resist that sort of pressure. Only a few do, and you do see them. And I mean, Robert Perry, who I respect as a journalist, he broke the Iran-Contra story, American veteran journalist, runs Consortium News. Okay, he published something about, I think it was about Andrea Tantaros, one of Fox News's spokesmodels who masquerades as a news contributor, but one of their sort of supermodel Fox news gals. He wrote a story about her because she said, America's so awesome, we're awesome. And he sort of took a swipe at it. But then he took that and molded it into a kind of thing that's about white people should feel guilty about slavery and dredging up all that stuff. Mm. I still respect him as a journalist. I respect his opinion on that. I'm not going to criticize him because that's his opinion. Myself, I wouldn't take the same angle on it because I see a much different drama playing out here with this issue. So, but that is something that it's very easy to bend to the mob. If we talk about any issue, if you talk about 9/11. There's a 9/11 mob out there that if you don't say that the buildings came down in this particular way, they will absolutely overrun you. I mean, we've got various little micro mobs that coalesce around different issues.
Yeah, because I mean, let's face it. Because you know, it's true. It's social, pressure, and it does work because people respond to it in the same way they respond to being, you know, afraid of being called a racist or, you know, an anti-Semite or what have you. It's these, you know, buzzwords triggered in order to kind of, you know, reel you in and get you, you know, smack you back in line, basically. And I think what's necessary here, is basically for people who don't give a shit. Just, you know, if is it the truth? Talk about it, get it out there. And that's the only thing that needs to be happening here. But of course, as we know, we have careers on the line. It's a very established, you know, media environment that is built up, obviously less so within the alternative. But even there's a certain kind of element of this that if you tread into territory and dare to question certain things, oh my God, you're out on a limb. That's it. You know, so, but people have to just, you know, we have to stop bowing to that pressure, because as long as we do that, as long as that has power, it, you know, we give it that power and we will, and we will bend to it, and we can't allow that to happen, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, I found this, you know, if you harp on the issue of race and you're constantly harping, you become very pleasant to be around, unpleasant to be around, I might say. And I found this when I worked in the corporate sector, or when I had my own business, the idea of race or gender or sexual identity politics, gay, straight, lesbian, black, white, Indian, it never came into it. Chinese, it never came into it for me, because in terms of hiring people, I didn't care too much about what their sexual orientation was or what country they were from. I only cared really about, could they do the job? Can I work with them? Do I like them? Are they dedicated to this particular cause that we've got going here at this company? If they tick those boxes, I really didn't care where they were from, what they were like, what color they were, etc. It never ever came into it. But when you make it an issue, if someone comes in there with a chip on their shoulder, then I'm going to think straight away that, I mean, this person might be hard to work with. So I'm not going to hire them. It's not based on their race. It's because they had a chip on their shoulder. And I think if they've got a chip on their shoulder about this and we just met, what sort of other chips are going to appear on their shoulder when we get down the road working together? And, you know, and then you've got all sorts of other issues with, you know, letting, what's like, when are you going to fire them? Are they going to resign? Do you have to fire them? Are you going to end up in an industrial tribunal? What type of person are we dealing with here? And so that's how I measured it on a personal level. Race has never come into that. But when someone comes and makes it an issue with me and is basically challenging me or accusing me of being guilty of some kind of an original sin, then I have a problem, and I have two choices there. I can either ignore it, or I can debate it, or I can counter what they're putting forth, their argument. And so I feel compelled to want to debate that issue, to challenge them, and to make them prove their case. And I will then prove my case. But we don't see this. We see a lot of shouting. We see a lot of nastiness. We saw this guy from the Global Grind. I think it's one of something affiliated with Russell Simmons in New York City, who's, I think he was involved with Run DMC, very wealthy, does a lot of good work in the communities, I might add. But he had one of his guys from the globalgrind.com, who is on the news, CNN and Fox and so forth, is from New York. Very emotional, shouting on air, not wanting to let the other person talk, very rude. I mean, just the sort of person you wouldn't want in charge. And you look at, these are the people that want to be in charge. These are the people that want to be leaders. They're out burning buildings in Ferguson, or saying, oh, it's okay, they're just emotional. It's, you know, the youths get emotional, and they didn't mean to burn down the building. That's just, you know, they're very, very upset, and they've got issues, and they feel like they're being discriminated against. So it's okay that,
right, it's justifying all this behavior all the time, and not, you know, not putting down a foot and saying, you know, that's it. We can't. I mean, if we're going to have a society, we can't have these things just, you know, continuing and kind of spiraling out of control in the way they do. But Patrick, before we get ahead of ourselves a little bit here, let's take a short break here and pick this up right after the break. I have so much more to, to talk about and ask you about as well, pertaining to what has been happening in Ferguson, but also extend the conversation out to some of the other things surrounding this that we haven't talked about yet. So let's just kind of push the pause button right here. But give us your website as usual, Patrick. Give us any details about that. If there's anything else you want to let our listeners know about that they can find on your website, please go ahead.
Sure. The website is 21stcenturywire.com. That's 21stcenturywire.com, 21stcenturywire.com. And Also, we have a live Sunday talk show, which is every Sunday. It's called The Sunday Wire, and that goes out 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 till 8 Greenwich Mean Time, UK time. So that's a Sunday show. So yeah, we're hitting as many of these issues as we can every week.
All right, very good. Links up on our website as well, folks. But stay with us, Patrick. We'll be right back after the short break here.
What we need to survive together.
We'll continue at redicemembers.com for another hour as we go deeper into the globalist agenda and deconstruct why mass immigration is about destroying homogeneous nations and turning Europe into a deracinated, more easily controllable place with a grunt species devoid of cultural anchoring, heritage, and pride in their own people. The very ideological founder of the European Union talked about this very step in the process. We get Patrick's take on some of the surrounding issues concerning race, biology, individuality, deconstruction of culture, human nature, and what the end game plan for the technocrats is as they bring in more control by creating more chaos with the aid of willing accomplices and naive, but unfortunately good-intended people who are making all the wrong decisions for all the wrong reasons. Well, please sign up for a membership and tune in to any of our past shows. We have over 900 programs in our archives. We also produce 3 new shows a week, so sign up and get access to the second hour of all our new shows as well. It's only €5 per month. You can try it out with a 3-month subscription. And of course, when you do, you help us to be able to continue to bring you exciting and important radio that questions everything that we've been told and show why the wisdom of our times is propaganda designed to drive us further towards the edge of Hades. Well, we have more coming up. The Swedish surveyor, Laird Scranton, Marion van Court, Conrad from Radio Landsman, and others are lined up as we march forward into the new year. Well, thank you, my friends. Please stay with us as we proceed in the members section. We'll talk to you after the break.